Good morning, Open Door. Yeah. Ooh. In front row, will you guys just come back every week and just worship with us? Yeah, very cool. Yeah, you guys. Well, open to Nehemiah chapter 6. Nehemiah chapter 6. It's incredible. Right here, verse 1 tells us that this whole project that Nehemiah promised Israel that they could do, they've completed. The wall's built. It's done all the way around this glistening, gleaming new wall, sometimes 23 feet in at the top width. It's done. Only needed a few doors and a few gates still need to be hung, but it's basically done. And you would think this would be the chapter now of huge celebration. It's interesting. I won't come for seven chapters. There's seven more chapters before we get up on the wall and celebrate. But the enemies are still here. They're still around us. Bye-bye. Thank you. Thank you for staying as long as you could. Everybody else feels the same way. They just don't get carried by someone else out of the room. You said, Joel Try said, I'm here for two services because my wife's teaching a class or in a class or something. He said, would you mix it up a little in the second service? That was it, right there. Okay. You know that this book is not about three bad guys, Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem. It's about evil. This is about how evil works. And it is also a book about how God works while evil is working. It's interesting. The same word in the Greek, peirasmos, is the same for temptation and test, depending on who's doing it. If it's the evil one, it's temptation. If it's the living God, it's always a test so that you can be confirmed as to who you are to you and to others. God already knows who you are. But now you'll watch something that happens. The wall's 98% built. No longer can Tobiah and Geshem and Sanballat and the others get inside the walls. So their strategy has to change. Evil's strategy has to change when they can no longer get inside. I make that analogy to me. In the early days, just the straight frontal attack would take me out. But I've grown up. I've matured. I'm still a wreck. I'm still all those things. But now the attacks have become different. The attacks are now attacks from outside. And you'll watch this. Now, these attacks now are no longer at a people. They're at an individual, Nehemiah. They're going after Nehemiah. They're going to take him down. They're going to try to hurt him, frighten him, intimidate him, and cause him to sin in his response to them. And they're going to try to rob his joy. These are the methodology of evil when it can no longer be inside and has to try a level 2 strategy. You're going to watch Nehemiah today take 3 shots from outside. They're all going to come from outside the walls. Each one of them is ugly. And the ugliest to me is the open letter. He's going to get a letter at some point in here that's ugly. Really ugly. And it's going to be used to have him retaliate and break his spirit, break his heart, judge his motives, have the people of Israel question what Nehemiah is really up to. When all he's been up to is beauty, it's going to cause him to second guess himself. It goes inside the wire. When you start to mature, the battles that you face and the issues, they go inside the wire and they attack at your identity, at who you are. What do you believe about God's trust of you as you grow up? If I had another example to use, I would use it because I hate using this example and this story, but it's so spot on with us that I have to use it. It's about what happened to my family 4 or 5 years ago. Some of you in this room remember it. We got a letter. We got an open letter. We got a hate letter. It was a Christmas letter. I used to write Christmas letters, and this person who hated us took the letter and reformatted it to make it look like one of my Christmas letters about my family, and they put in horrible, mean, vulgar, seditious, slanderous, ugly stuff. And they wrote it to me, and they said, a bunch of these are going to go out Christmas time to your friends. And don't worry about the cost for postage. We'll take care of that. And they did. They sent it out to some people. There's nothing I could do about it. And they said, mark our words. This will go out every Christmas to more friends. And it was intended to frighten me, to hurt me, to intimidate me and my family, and to cause me to sin in my response and to rob our joy. And I hate to say this, but it worked on all 5 levels. It frightened me that someone could hate us so much. It hurt me to discover that someone who knew us could hate us so much. It intimidated me, that thought that I can't do anything and they're going to send these out maybe again. And it caused me to sin in response. I remember gathering all of our family together and I said, now listen, you guys. I don't want you to try to figure out who this person is. I don't want you to come up with any names or any pictures in your head of who could have done it. And I've got like 8 in my head that I'm thinking it is. I knew it was Grace Thrall. I knew. That woman, she's been setting this thing up for years. All nice and friendly and stuff. I can see it. I'm not stupid. You imagine, you've got 8 names of who it could be, and 7 of them just have your back and they're for you. That's what that garbage does. And it caused us to lose joy. I never sent out another Christmas letter. A lot of you are going, thank you. Thank you to that person. We were so sick of those letters. But it did. It robbed my joy. Today, Nehemiah says, I'm going to take the same shots. And I want to show you a way home. I want to show you what wisdom does in the middle of attack. These shots are going to come right at Nehemiah now. They know the wall's built. They can't get to Israel, but we can get to their leader and make sure that Israel is not strong. So evil had to change its tactics and refine its strategy. For the first time, it gets under the wire about me. And now it's focused on the gaps in the wall regarding this. Have I settled that God is enough that he can take care of me and my reputation and my future and my past and my present fears? This is level 2 stuff. God allows, remember, perosmos, tests to reveal your new nature to you so you will have great hope that God is doing beauty in you. And for others, so that they can see how you live this out and they can trust you and be protected in your influence. But at the same time, the evil one is using the same event to try to tempt you so that you will be disqualified to yourself and from your influence and trust from others. And so this level 2 attack, I'm discovering that it demands a level 2 maturity and a level 2 response. Words like wisdom, the ability to pull up the life principle that fits this exact situation, discernment, accuracy, and being able to read motive and character, insight, that quick ability to size up what's really going on behind the issue, objectivity, the ability to stay freed from those hooks of subjectivity that trap me and tie me up so that I'm self-consumed, objectivity that frees me to be present so that I can read between the lines, and perception so that I can discern the incongruent. The incongruent elements hiding behind the obvious. This wisdom, this discernment, this insight, this perception, this objectivity is sometimes really rare. Really rare. Even in a faith community, it's very, very rare of people that I go, you have wisdom. When I get hit, when I get scared, I can come to you and I can come under you because you're wise. Gosh, is that rare. Gosh, is that a beautiful thing to pursue. To be able to be a gift to others when they get caught up and freaked out and overwhelmed because you have wisdom. Gosh, it is like gold to them. We may have heard 7,000 sermons, filled in the blanks on thousands of sermon outlines, and read the Bible dozens of times, and listened to Christian music all day long, attended Bible studies for 20 years, but you can still be full of just common opinion with only cliched answers if you don't have wisdom. That passage in Hebrews 5 is fascinating. Remember what he says, the writer of Hebrews says regarding this very thing. You know, we've got so much more that we want to say, but it's hard to explain because you've become dull of hearing. You first came to Christ, you were all excited, but you didn't come under it and obey it. You just kind of said, yeah, that's great. But you didn't come under it, and so you became anesthetized to it. For though by this time you ought to be teachers, you have again to have someone to teach you the elementary principles of the oracles of God. You've come to need milk and not solid food. For everyone who partakes only in milk is not accustomed to the word of righteousness. He's still a kid. Now listen to what he says. Fascinating. But solid food is for the mature, who because of practice have had their senses trained to discern between good and evil. Not obvious good and evil, but subtle good and evil. Evil that is not always presenting itself as evil. And good that always doesn't sometimes easily be seen as good right away. These who are mature have had their senses trained by practice in wisdom to discern. So what does this practice look like? It's different than any other kind of a practice that you would ever come under to get wisdom. See, we've said it before. Knowledge can puff up. As great as knowledge is, it has a downside. It can make you arrogant. It can make you think you are all that. Same thing, information. You can get, and so many of us have been under a system where we've learned, if I just get information about this book, I'll be great. I'll really, that'll be the answer. But it makes you smug. It doesn't have to, but it can. But truth, this whole realm of that which is experienced, discernment, wisdom, perception, insight, it involves practice. But it's a radically different practice than the skill that would receive knowledge. Knowledge is gained cognitively through the mind primarily. And so I can get it from anybody. I don't care who you are, I can get knowledge and information from anybody. I don't have to trust you, I don't have to respect you, I don't have to in any way come under you. But if you want truth, discernment, wisdom, insight, perception. See, that's going to take something really different. And it's not something we're used to doing. I've got to trust somebody. I've got to trust God when He disagrees with the way I want to go. I've got to trust somebody else other than myself, or I'll be this self-referencing system. And I'll never become wise. I'll keep shooting myself in the foot and not knowing why. Interesting, Solomon calls it a gift. In Ecclesiastes 2, 25 and 26, he says, wisdom is an actual gift from God, and He gives it to those who trust Him. It's a gift. Oh, I want that gift so much. And he says, it is. It's a gift from God to those who trust Him. So the practice is to learn to how to let your heart learn to trust truth. I've got to learn to trust God's Word and to come under its influence. I've got to learn to trust wise humans and come under their influence. Ask them lots of questions and ask them why. Why did you see it that way over here when I saw it this way? Why? How did you come up with that? Not just the answer that you gave me, but how did you get there? I want to do that. I want to come under wise people. I must learn to submit myself when my conclusions disagree with those that I've come under. I've got to learn to trust others with me, with my person, even though I really, really want to be a free agent. I just wrote a bunch of these down. Practice, this is what it looks like. First of all, it's painful because you have to realize you don't have what you need to help the ones you most love. When you start out at practice of anything, it is really painful to discover how out of condition you are. Practice is learning to stop talking until you're convinced you have something to say that will build up and meet the need of the moment. Practice walks through scenarios with God and the why, and the wise learning why this truth fits this situation but doesn't fit that one. Practice submits as to a coach. It takes what that person says as counsel, not as advice that they compare with their own. If their coach says it, in an area that they've been entrusted, he just says, I'm going to try it. Sad thing in a book I was reading about Tiger Woods, it said Hank Haney would give him instruction, and 90% of it, Tiger would just ignore. 5% of it, he would try and it wouldn't work and he would ignore it. 5% of it he used. 5% of it he would take of it and he said, I'm just going to trust this. Tiger could have golfed on the moon if he'd taken 45%. Practice stops asking for a fish and spends the quiet hours that it takes to learn to fish. Practice concerns itself less with filling in blanks than a sermon outline and starts listening to that speaker's way of seeing God's heart. Practice is reading the Bible not just for particular verses, but to start listening to the way that God sees life. Practice reads less self-help books and instead spends more time pondering lives of the wise. Practice is not satisfied until it can put the great thoughts of others into their own words and apply them. Practice is admitting that your wounding may have kept you from vulnerability. Practice is admitting that your wounding has kept you self-protective. Practice is trusting God with hard things that are revealed about me so I can be objective. Practice is learning to withhold the right answer until I've learned how to help the other be able to want the right answer. Practice is learning to not just give an answer to fill space. Practice is to be present in the moment with God, to listen to Him, to allow Him to communicate to your heart so that you have something to say. Practice is learning a running dialogue with God all through the day. where you're just saying, God, here I am right now. I'm a little confused right now. I'm a little frightened right now. I don't understand this right now. I just want to talk it through. I just want to be here with you. Practice is allowing others' pain to force you to God for answers. Practice is reading God's Word not because you should, but because it holds life. Practice learns to receive the relationship of three different words, humility, love, and trust, and work them together. Humility, love, and trust. Trusting God and others, putting myself under that person and receiving their love and becoming wise. That's the practice. The humble are those who trust God and others with themselves, and they become wise. It's okay for me to stop right now and just say, some of us are thinking, gosh, here I am. I'm 20, I'm 42, I'm 61, I'm 83, and I'm not wise. And I'm tired of not being wise. I've not trusted you with me, God. I've not trusted anyone with me. I've trusted you for salvation, but basically, I take over during the day. And I'm not wise. And I am tired of playing the fool. I'm tired of being tripped up and shooting myself in the foot. I'm tired of having little insight and wisdom or discernment for those I love. You can make me wise, God. I'm scared to do this. But I want to trust you with me right now. I desperately want this gift so I can be your gift to others. Now you're going to watch a man who is wise. He's going to detect deceit in verses 1 through 4. He's going to answer slander in verses 5 through 8. He's going to overcome fear in verse 9. He's going to break this horrible entrapment that he gets placed into in verse 10. So if I look at this passage, right out of the gate, it says what we talked about. When it was reported to Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem the Arab and to the rest of our enemies that I had rebuilt the wall and that no breach remained in it, although at the time I had not set up the doors and the gates, Sanballat and Geshem sent a message to me. All of a sudden, these men who had threatened Israel's life had become such nice guys. They said, come on! Nehemiah, dude, come on. We love you. And again, this is out of the NIV at this point. Would you meet with us in Cherethim in the plain of Ono? Come on. And they would send it on nice stationery embossed. Four of them. They just kept sending notes. Maybe you didn't get the last one. We know how it can be in this new kind of frontier land that we're in. So we thought we'd send you another one. We're down in Ono, and it was beautiful, lush land, 20 miles away from Jerusalem. It was, come on! There's hot springs here, dude! Come on! Yeah, we've had some differences. Sure we have, you knucklehead. And Nehemiah goes, what are they up to? You lugheads. When someone has threatened to kill you and demoralizes your family and countrymen and shames you and mocks you and intimidates you and causes friends to turn from you and you receive a letter to meet in their hometown, you might just want to give pause for a moment before you pack up and go down to meet them in Ono. And so he says to them, they wrote these letters and he says, these simple words. Nehemiah was not a poet. He says, they were planning to harm me. So I sent messages to them saying, look, I'm doing a great work and I can't come down there. Why would I stop the work while I leave it and come down to you? Well, I sent four different messages in this way. They knew how he would answer, but they had to do it so that they could have some data. Hey, we tried with this guy, man. He's been fully unreasonable. We had no choice but to do the next thing, and the next thing is the open letter. Verse 5. Then Sanballat sent his servant to me in the same manner a fifth time. This time he's got an open letter in his hand. There is no more deep insult that you can give in the Orient, in the East, than to come and read an open letter. It's for the public. It's like a petition. A messenger would come and he would, "Hear ye, hear ye! All assemble now!" And he would open this letter for everyone to hear. And all of Jerusalem now is standing around hearing this. "It is reported among the nations, and Gashmu says, that you, Nehemiah, you and the Jews are planning to rebel. Therefore, you are rebuilding the wall, and you, you're to be their king, according to these reports. You've also appointed prophets to proclaim in Jerusalem concerning you, a king is in Judah. And now it will be reported to the real king. According to these reports, so come, come now. These are reasonable men, Nehemiah. Come. Come, let's reason together." Whew. Man, did this hurt? Did this hurt Nehemiah? This went inside the wire. What do you do? I mean, all of a sudden, have you ever done that? You're totally innocent, but you feel like you've done something wrong. Nehemiah didn't do anything wrong, but suddenly everybody in town, hey, good to see you. We gotta go. People were so freaked out. They didn't know what to do. There's no response to it. Nehemiah can't have 5 minutes. "Could I have a rebuttal, please?" It is the worst, and they knew it. It was so awkward around Jerusalem. It's got all the elements of a slanderous rumor of gossip. No sources quoted or known, for that matter. It's reported among the nations. Oh, good, I'll track that down. It's built on hearsay and gossip. Gashmu says... You know, Gashmu, we've never heard of him before, ever. But he says. He does, he says. And then the rumor maker doesn't check first with you, and it's exaggerated and full of inaccuracy, and it's designed to hurt and frighten you and trip you up into a rash response, and it pretends to those they've poisoned that they have your best interest. Oh, look at these guys. They've written all these letters. They're heroic, even now reaching out to that stubborn Nehemiah. God love them. And it's told to those who have no ability or authority or right to help solve, and it's fully intended to separate loyalties and to tear apart Israel. And it's fully intended to freak out Nehemiah. And it reveals hurt and immaturity and woundedness in the one who listens to it, and it reveals fear and wounding and jealousy and immaturity and envy in the rumor giver. I love Nehemiah's response. He says in verse 8, "Well, I sent a message to him saying, you know, such things as you are saying have not been done. You are inventing them in your own mind. Hey, boys, you're in a fantasy world. You're making up stuff. I didn't do any of that. None of that's happened. None of it. Zero. And I'm not coming down to the oh no. He teaches us, don't try to track down everybody who's been affected by the rumor. You can't do it. Everybody gets revealed. This is where you have to say, God, you are sovereign, and you are in control of my life, and you have my back, and you can vindicate me, and you can defend my name. I cannot track down the damage. I just can't do it. I want to do it. I want to go tell everybody they're liars, and I want to tell you some things about their families." And he doesn't. Don't try to defend yourself publicly from rumors that have been formed privately. Go directly to the gossiper. Don't buy the bait of manipulative pressure to attack back. It's what they want. It's how they're going to win. Respond to those who come to you to ask about the rumor. If someone says, "Gosh, is that true, Nehemiah? Oh, no, you guys. Oh, yeah, I'd be glad to talk to you about that." Stay free from the inflaming of unforgiveness so that you don't get trapped and you don't get sick in your own heart and inflamed. And let God be your vindicator. God, I know who I am. You know who I am. And you're either big enough to take care of me, or I'm done. God, be supernaturally powerful now. Defend my name in whatever timing you want. I know that you love me more than I love me, and that you care for me more than I care for myself, and your righteousness is at stake. I'm getting out of the way. Now, the problem with this, and I'll divert for a moment, sadly, this happens inside the camp more often than it does outside the camp. Sometimes we do this to each other. Not in this next generation. Not in this sweet family. See, those sharing what's not theirs to share display a lack of wisdom. See, wisdom does something else. It causes me to slow down and ask these questions. Is it necessary for me to say this? Does it build up for me to say this? Do I have any right to say this? See, here's what you may have forgotten when you choose to give yourself permission to down-talk another. The ones that you're telling may listen, but ultimately they may not trust you. They may pass on what you thought that was going to be kept just between you. And they may distort what you say, and others will blame you for the distortion. And others out there will find out and learn to disrespect you and not trust you. And the person that you gossiped about, when they find out that it's you, they will not sleep until you are dead. And you always, every time, every single time you do it, you tear down community. You hurt community. I want to do that for a second. You've played that game before at parties, I think, where you start a rumor and then it ends up and you see what it sounds like. But you start with words. I'm going to do it right here. I'm going to do it with this cool first row. There's not a chance you get this right. I'm going to just start with a simple line. I just want to, now none of these people have any motive to hurt me or to hurt anyone else, but just listen how distorted it gets when it goes through a community. All right? Guys, I want you to say it to each other, whisper it to each other to where nobody can hear it, and then Hannah, you'll be at the end. You'll tell me what I said, and say it exactly. Get it exactly right as much as you can, okay? All right? Here we go. I don't care if you can hear. All right, go. Go quickly. Quickly. Don't swear. Really odd, Joe. Hannah, out loud, what did I say?
These glasses John got made me look like a punk.
Very good. Never mind. My whole point has now been disproved. It was actually these glasses John got from Costco make him look like a bug.
Oh. Yeah.
You guys were unbelievable. Well done. So, the point is, go ahead and say anything. It'll always get exactly right by the people who hear it. No, the point is this, you guys. This community, this fragile, beautiful community, here's something you may not know. The whole world is watching you. They are. They're watching you and a bunch of other places to see if an environment of grace really can work. They're watching to see if such a thing as a safe place can actually happen in a community. And so here's our banner. It's in Ephesians 4:29. Listen to what it says. He's talked for three chapters about identity. And now he says, here's the privilege you get. You don't have to let any unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word that is good to build others up. According to the need of the moment, so that it will give grace to those who hear. Those words right there will protect this community. People living out of who they are in Christ, saying, this is how we want to live with each other. This is going to be our way of life. It's not the way I grew up in. It's not the way that I came from. But it is what we're going to have together. Let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word that's good to build each other up according to the need of the moment, so it'll give grace to those here. And I know you hear that and you go, well, what would we talk about then? Oh, you guys, all the beauty of love of who you are in Christ is what you get to talk about. You get to play and build each other up, because everybody that you know is being attacked this way by the evil one. Everyone you know. Every single one of us needs to be built up by each other and protected by each other. Well, thirdly, he now faces the fear, because it's gotten inside the wire on Nehemiah. So three times in here, Nehemiah says, they're trying to frighten me, God, please, I'm scared. Verse 9, he says it. And then he says it over in verse 13. Then he says it in verse 14 again. See, here's the danger of fear. Look in verse 13. This guy was hired for this reason, that I might become frightened and act accordingly and sin. Remember what Proverbs 29 says about fear? The fear of man, it brings a snare. But he who trusts in the Lord will be exalted. So evil's plan is to bring the innocent to discouragement and doubt their own motives and take the perception of their reputation into their own hands. And so Nehemiah has to take his hurt to God. So sweet in verse 9, he says, God, they're trying to discourage me. Will you strengthen my hands? Protect me, God. I need you so much. I'm terrified. What do? I get frightened every day. There's that verse in Psalm 56:3 that I just love so much. It brings me home like a little kid. Here's Nehemiah. He's a man's man. And he's saying basically what the psalmist says. When I am afraid, as soon as I'm aware that I'm afraid, I'm going to trust you. I will trust in you. And it's not just some vague, there's specific trust for someone who's afraid. I just wrote a few down really quickly. When I'm afraid, I will trust you. This is what I'll trust about you. I'll choose to believe first that I'm not alone, that you're right in the arena with me. And even if I've fallen down, you're standing over me. I choose to believe that you've already seen this and you've signed off on it. You're in control. I choose to believe that you will only do perfectly by me. I choose to believe that you can and that you will vindicate my name. Eventually, you will work this out and make sense of it to me, God. I choose to believe that you will not buy into the lies that fear tells me. I choose to believe that calling on you will calm my heart. I choose to believe that nothing can happen that's going to affect you and I. I choose to believe and trust that this will end well, that you know how this ends. I choose to believe that you will not mock my pain, that you're not standing outside going, yeah, whatever. I choose to believe that you're watching every single moment, missing nothing. I choose to believe that you care more about me than I care about me. I choose to believe that I'm not identified by anything that can happen to me. I choose to believe that my shame was born at the cross and it no longer defines me. I choose to believe that you can hold my life together no matter what. And I choose to believe that you know how to protect me from all evil that wants to hurt me. Now listen to what that does, you guys. There is something palpable and tangible about when I'm afraid I will trust in you. When I do it, it breaks the pattern of evil. It breaks the power of evil. It breaks the stranglehold of evil's presence and its darkness. I regain my objectivity. I'm at rest. I'm at peace. I'm safe. I'm not hidden in my lonely fear. I'm free from the trap of evil that thrives in my fear. I get to enjoy my God. I'm free to love and care for those who are around me. I'm available. And I get to worship. I stand up and I worship and I call out and say, God, you did it. You've been good. Well, there's one more trap, and it's the worst one. This one's ugly. They realized nothing else has worked, and even the letter didn't work. His integrity is so great that the people eventually realized what was written is not true about Nehemiah. So they've got one more plan. Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem do this one. It's in verse 10. When I entered the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, son of Methabel, who was confined at home, the guy was confined. It may have been a religious confinement, a ceremonial confinement, but it was probably he was lame, crippled. He said, let us meet together in the house of God within the temple, and let's close the doors of the temple because they're gonna come kill you. They're going to come kill you at night. Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for that encouragement, Shemaiah. Now, this guy's a prophet. He's a prophet of God. And the proposal actually comes, it's written in the original, in an oracle form. They're coming for you. Oh, they're coming for you at night. That freaked me out. Every night I go to bed. What was that? Shemaiah! They're coming for you, Nehemiah. Nehemiah! After a couple of nights of no sleep, I think I'd go, Shemaiah, let's go into the temple. Except listen to what he knows. Why is he makes this interesting statement. He says, I perceive that surely God had not sent him. How does he know that? He knows because he knows the word. Back in 2 Chronicles. Remember Uzziah goes into the temple and he's struck with leprosy? You don't go into the temple unless you're a priest. The prophet knows that. Nehemiah goes, what doesn't add up here? Huh. Shemaiah's a prophet. He knows better. He's confined at home, but somehow he's suddenly able to walk to the temple. Wonder if anyone like Tobiah or Sanballat or Geshem has anything to do with this. He's freed. And this man is protected and he's safe because of wisdom and trust when he got afraid. And that's John Lynch. Every single day, I need you guys protecting me. I need you guys doing Ephesians 4:29 to me. Every single person in this room does. That's why we come to this table. When I'm afraid, I'll trust you, God. I'll trust that this means something. That Jesus going to the cross, you know, he was afraid. He was terribly afraid. He said, Father, I'm scared. Dad, I'm going to do this, but I'm afraid. He knows exactly what I feel to the dregs. I have fears about my past, about how they're going to affect my present and my kids and my family. I have fears of the presence, financial, relational, significance fears. I have fears of my future health and security. And unless I take it to God, if I hold on to it, I'm not present. I'm hidden, and I'm scared, and I'm susceptible to evil. Right now, you guys, come to the table. You could say these words to God. Psalm 56:3, Father, I'm afraid. I'm going to trust in you.